Hello, Jason. This is Jeff and Soraya.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
We're doing great.
And this week, enjoy the second part of our conversation with Jason Faulkner. You release all these solo records, and the last couple of them on a Japanese label, Noise McCartney Records. What inspired you to release those last couple of records there?
You mean where, like, it's really hard for everybody else to get?
So
the quick answer to that is that the label in Japan was the only label that was banging down my door and offer me a bag of money.
Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme.
A podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, agrubiar.
Let's get groovy. So they offered you
that's why that happened. That was never intended to be, you know, just a Japanese release. And then, you know, a couple of years later, I put that out again. My friends at Cobra Side, that's when the LP came out. Mm-hmm.
But that was, I'm Okay, You're Okay, but not All Quiet on the Noise Floor, right? That one hasn't been released in the States.
That's right. Whenever I get this new record done and figure out how I'm going to put that out, my plan is to release All Quiet on the Noise Floor kind of as an announcement that there's a new record coming, but here's the last one that was only available in Japan, and do LPs and all that stuff.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And finally get that up streaming as well, because that's not even on Spotify.
Oh, wow. So, it seems there is no saving grace in this human forsaken place where culture dumps its tragic waste on you. But maybe the
That's my plan with that.
In that campaign, are you also including Presents Author Unknown and Can You Still Feel? I know you had mentioned
That previously. That would be something else. That would be a different thing. I mean, Omnivore's been wanting to put those out for years, and I love those guys. I'm not totally sure that that's the right place to do it, even though a lot of people would say that's like the perfect place. I'd like to find a way to get those out where there's a little bit more of an emphasis on like promoting this as a current thing, even though those records are decades old.
Okay.
I want to avoid the legacy artist thing because that's not what I am. I'm not like done, you know, and I don't feel like, oh, that was my good time. And now I'm just kind of like making music every once in a while. You know what I mean? I want to avoid that perception because that's not how I feel at all. Whoever I figure out to put out this new one, maybe we'll do those two Elektra ones. I'll do it through them. I don't know yet because I'm about halfway into this new record. So again, once that's like shaping up and almost done, I'll start shopping that and I'm going to figure out something. And I'm definitely not putting it out myself.
Are you playing most of the instruments on the new record?
Yeah, it's the same essential formula that I've been doing my whole life. I'm playing pretty much everything. I'm having my girlfriend plays violin beautifully and harp. So there's a there's a little bit of violin on the record, which is very cool. But it's not in a traditional sense. It's not like it's not like a folk, a little folk violin.
Yeah,
it's more like, yeah, it's not the Water Boys, okay? it's still going to be very much like what I've always been doing, but there's just some kind of like reinforcement of that, of certain chordal things that with violin too, where you might not even hear this violin, but you just kind of hear this texture of the something being bowed, and you can't even really tell what it is.
Wow. Okay.
Like I love like obscuring sounds. I love when, like, my favorite records of all time, you know, my favorite moments are always things where you can't really tell what the instrument is that's making that sound.
Oh.
You know, I mean, I love like distorted guitars, you know, a nice, beautifully recorded piano. But at the same time, I love when you're hearing these things and you can't really identify what they are. So that's kind of part of my whole aesthetic as well. There's a lot of stuff where I blend different instruments to make one sort of arranged part, and you can't really tell what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. You know.
Well, and Jeevan, just one quick follow up. So with the, you know, just looking ahead to the new album being done, is the goal to have it be released through streaming, you know, digital download and LP, or just one of those first?
Oh, definitely LP, and it'll certainly be streaming and all that stuff. And I mean, I want to make sure that there's more of a kind of a global release as opposed to just these territory things, like my last ones being the Japan first or Japan only. Like I'm definitely going to not do it that way. It'll be more like this is available everywhere, mm-hmm. right here. You can buy it, or you can listen to it on all these different platforms. You know.
And is that the goal also for the, you know, after that, the re-releases of a couple of your solo albums also in the same way? Global streaming and...
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure.
Would you plan on following that up with like a tour to support the new album?
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. Awesome. This record will be done. Like, so here's the deal. I actually do have a little bit of pressure with the time crunch kind of thing, which I mentioned earlier, I work well with. I don't have any Beck stuff really until like early July.
Okay.
So I have this nice window right now, where I'm going to be finishing this record. And then while I'm finishing it, figuring out how to get it out, who to put it out with. And so this record will without a doubt be out this year. Probably, you know, in the fall.
Okay. Wow.
That's very cool. I'm so excited. I didn't even know that you were working on new material. So this is really cool to hear.
Yes. Total scoop.
Oh man, this is by far the best one. And you know, if I didn't feel that way, I probably shouldn't be making it, you know, but I really do think that it's kind of the most, I do really feel it's the best stuff. I mean, it's just kind of more direct in mm-hmm. a way. And it's a continuation of what I've been doing. So it's not going to be like, what is he doing? You know, it's like, it still very much sounds like me, but it's just a little bit more direct.
Okay.
If you know what I mean. Like not quite as many things making it obscure.
So you're not going to go from 16 tambourines to Vermillion on us.
I will never make my own Vermillion. I'm just saying it right now. There will never be a Vermillion.
This is
You heard it here first. No Vermillion.
So Jason,
but we're excited to know that there's an album that, and there'll be a tour, because Jeff and I are really excited to hear that. So thanks for sharing that.
Yes.
Oh, awesome. Yes. Thank you.
So Jason, what about the Bedtime with the Beatles releases? So you put out two of those. I'm imagining you're a Beatles fan, but what inspired you to do Lullaby Sleepy Time versions of those? And it kind of ties into what you were saying with making different sounds, because I noticed there's some sounds on there that are, I'm not sure where they come from, but I imagine you incorporated some of that in your recording process. But what inspired you to do those type of versions of those songs?
Yeah, so the first one, I had just fired a manager that I had, that I had worked on the Can You Still Feel record with. So he had only been my manager for a couple of years. And I let him go. And then I was driving home and I was like, wow, the uncertainty of it all, really. And and I just didn't know what was going to be in my future. And I literally got home, checked my voicemails, and there was a message from this girl that I was friends with that worked at Sony Wonder, which is like their kids department label. And she was like, I have this crazy idea, and it's like the Beatles, but it's for kids, like for babies. It's not for kids. It's like to put your baby asleep. So it's for the parents, you know, but it's like a very sleep inducing Beatle thing. And my first reaction was hell no, because I was like, why don't you just play the kid, the Beatles?
Yeah.
I mean, like we can skip over Helter Skelter, you know, there's plenty of Beatles stuff.
You could play Here, There, and Everywhere.
lots of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so my knee-jerk reaction was, this is not for me. And then I thought about it for a day. And she's like, you're like the only guy on my list of people that I would want to do this. And so I called her back the next day and I was like, so just tell me. So there's no vocals, right? No, I don't want to suffer from Peter Frampton syndrome, you know? And she was like, no vocals. And I was like, okay, so no vocals. That's good. And then I was like, so, and I can do anything I want to their music. And she's like, yeah. And I was like, all right, I'm in. So so the first thing I did, and I did this at this tremendous studio here in LA that used to be called Ocean Way. And now it's called United, but, you know, it's just one of my favorite recording studios in the world. And, I this is pretty funny too. I remember I had all my gear delivered. And I was in the lounge with the guy that was going to be engineering it with me. And I knew him from work, from some stuff I had done, like with Nigel Godrich. And he had been an assistant. He had been an engineer on like the Travis stuff.
Oh, okay.
When I first met him, because mm-hmm. I worked with those guys that had been on their man. And, like right up until we were starting this Beatle record. So I hadn't really talked to the engineer, but I knew him. But I show up with all my gear and it's all being brought into the studio. And he's like, so Jason, what are we doing here? And I'm like, oh, get this. It's a, it's like a sleepy time Beatle record. Like a, you know, it's like for the little babies, you know? And he's like, and he goes, I don't really like the Beatles. And I was like, wait, what?
What?
So that was a pretty funny way that it started. Of course he wasn't totally serious, but he was into some different stuff than I was at the time. And I, you know, of course I don't take anybody seriously if they say they don't like the Beatles. I just think they haven't listened to the Beatles. And I feel like that's really a, just somebody trying to be a contrarian, really.
Uh-huh.
But so we started making that record. It was super fun. The first thing I did, because I hadn't totally digested the, like, put your baby to sleep concept, that was the entire concept. I hadn't really digested that yet, and I was thinking about, like, you know, Harry Nilsson's The Point and other kind of, like, childlike things that I really love. And so I did, I believe the first song I recorded was I Will.
Oh.
Which didn't end up on that first record, but it's on the second one. And I did that, and it has, like, you know, it's still slow and instrumental, but it's got a little kick and snare and, you know, sizzle cymbal. And I remember the girl from the label came down to hear the first thing I had recorded. And she was like, well, this is brilliant, but it's not the vibe.
Oh.
I'm like, well, what do you mean it's not the vibe? And she's like, well, it's just like, it has drums. drums. And I'm like, well, yeah, but I'm barely hitting them. She's like, yeah, but, you know, like, what about just no drums? And I was like, I'm just such a, like, I love drumming. I love drums. I love everything about drums. And so I had my 66 Ringo kit that I still have just set up in the middle of the room. And I'm just looking at the drumstick going, no drums. What? And then she laughed. And then I just started thinking, okay, so no drums. And then I was like, okay, so now I'm just going to, like, what about, like, this kind of a soundtrack to, like, a lunar landing? You know, just, like, this really, really, like, morphined out, just, like, slow, deliberate. And so that's basically what was always in my mind, was kind of everything sounding like a soundtrack to a lunar landing. And, you know, or just like a spaceship, like adrift in space, just like they ran out of gas or whatever, you know? That was kind of what was always in my mind. So all the songs kind of have this, you know, otherworldly, but really slowed down thing. And I also remember doing some piano on something, and, you know, it was just me and an engineer. There's nobody else on that whole record. There's nobody else in the studio. Just two of us. And I was me playing everything all the time. So it's just me by myself with a guy behind the glass. And I just remember I was playing, and I started, like, falling asleep. And while I was playing, and I was like, oh man, I was like, oh, sorry, sorry, start that over. And I look over, and he's totally asleep on the console.
Eureka! I found the formula.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, okay, this I'm nailing it. And, but yeah, he was completely conked out. So that's when I realized this record is actually going to work.
Nice.
And, you know, do its intended job. And, you know, I've had the very pleasurable reactions over the years, the most notable being from Paul McCartney himself, saying how much he loves it and how much it works. And it, you know, put his new daughter at the time, his baby Beatrice, put her to see. Like, he raised her on my version of the Beatles.
Wow.
Which is just, like, there's so many things like that that, I mean, I hear still, like, every week I hear from somebody, and a lot of people that I actually really respect, or I'm a fan of, talking about how much those records, that's like the only thing their kids want to listen to, and their kids are now like 10 or older, and they still listen to those records all the time.
Wow.
Because they were raised on them. And that's just such a wonderful thing for me to have, you know, kind of in my, you know, in my soul, really. It's just like this knowledge that there's entire generations of kids whose first introduction to the Beatles is via me.
Wow.
That just blows my mind.
That is so cool.
That's pretty trippy.
It's pretty trippy.
And, you know, it begs the question. And in 2004, 2005, you worked with Sir Paul on a couple of songs for his album Chaos and Creation in the Backyard. So was this the link, or how did you get to come to collaborate with him?
Well, that was through the producer, Nigel Godrich, who I had worked with on my Can You Still Feel record. And he called me one day and was just like, hey, I think I'm going to be producing Paul McCartney. And he's like, do you want to be part of, like, the foundation of those tracks? You know, he said, I really want to kind of steer Paul back into kind of playing a lot of the instruments, including drums.
Mm-hmm.
So he said that it was myself on guitar and piano and stuff, and Paul on bass, guitar, piano, and whatever he wants to play. And then the drummers were James Gadson from Bill Withers' band, and who we had all worked with before. James Gadson is a genius. And then some of it is Joey Warnker from the Beck Band. And so that's how that happened. Oh,
see me grow into a better man than the one you know. Sometimes my head is hanging low. It's time to get on with the show.
You know, the first couple of days with Paul, I brought the pink cover and the blue cover of that Bedtime with the Beatles record. I had it in my pocket the whole time. And I was kind of like waiting for a moment. This is important, because I had heard from somebody that worked at Sony, that they were at a party in New York and they overheard, and they were talking, they were talking about this, my record, with somebody at this party. And they said that Stella McCartney, I guess, the person said they didn't even notice that Stella McCartney was standing right next to them. And she interrupted the conversation and said, "Are you talking about that Bedtime with the Beatles record?" She said, "That record is amazing." And the girl was like, yeah, that's, well, the Jason Fonger did that, but I brought that idea to her or whatever. And she said, I just love that. I'm going to give it to my dad.
Oh my gosh.
So this is a couple of years before I worked with him. So that's why I brought it, because I thought, hey, he already knows this record, because surely Stella has given it to him by now. Well, so the second or third day working with him, we kind of like are in the studio in the tracking room. We were just facing each other. We were the only people in the tracking room. Poor James is stuffed in a little vocal booth, and then it's me and Paul looking at each other in this giant tracking room.
Oh my gosh!
And in order to go and listen to what we did, we put down our instruments, and then we would kind of like have to go around all these fake trees and stuff in the studio. Okay. I was like the guy's in the Beatles. Can't we get some real trees? but we would convene in this little area and walk into the control room from there. And I remember he put his arm around me. He's like, "Sounds great, Jace." You know, I'm like, "Oh man, like this is such a thrill." And he's like, "Oh, this sounds really good." And so that's when I was like, I clumsily pulled these two CDs out of my blazer pocket. I'm like, "Hey, have you ever heard these?" And he's like, "No, what is it, Jace?" And I'm like, "Well, it's this record I made in this room a couple of years ago, and it's like instrumental versions of your band." And and he's like, "Oh no, I'll check it out." And I remember we went in and we were listening back at what we had just recorded, and he was opening one of the CD booklets at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And he pulls out the artwork and he sees that picture of me at the piano holding the apple by the stem, and he's like, and he looks up and he goes, "Cheeky, man, that's cheeky." and I'm like, "Yes, it is. I suppose that is, that's pretty cheeky." And so I didn't go back into the studio for a few days after that, because Nigel was concentrating on just recording Paul. And so I think it was about a week, and I had to go and get some of my stuff because I had a solo show at the Troubadour, I think. And so I went back in there, and this is where the story gets crazy. I walk in, and I'm rounding the corner down the hallway, and I see Nigel and the other guys in the control room. But, Paul is not – I don't see Paul. And Nigel's like, "Oh, hey, man." And he pushes the talk back on the console. He goes, "Hey, Paul, guess who it is?" And you just hear, "Is it Jace?" Oh. And I'm like, "Wait, why is he, why am I the first name that he's saying?" Like, there's a lot of heavy dudes that were coming by and saying hi, a lot of Paul's friends from the years. And the first thing he says is it Jace? So I'm like, "Well, that's crazy." So I lean my head in, I look through the glass, and I see him, and he's holding a tambourine. He's like, "Jace, Bedtime with the Beatles, man, nice one." And I'm like, "What?" And he's like, wait, can you hang out for a bit? And he comes in, and then he basically just says all this insanely flattering stuff to me, like how he sat down and listened to it with his friends. And he said, I'm like, he literally said, I'm flattered that you made this. And I'm like, oh my God, man, all the flattery is mine. Believe me. But he had to get some, I knew that he really listened to it because he goes, that little thing you did before the Calliope bit on Fool on the Hill, he said, it's like Bill Evans or something. Crazy thing about that is when I recorded that, because I did change, I changed the chords right there, and I did this kind of swing, this little kind of triplet swing thing, and my thought when I came up with that was, it sounds kind of like Bill Evans.
Wow.
So that just ripped my head off when he when he confirmed that, you know, and
he picked up on that.
He picked exactly.
Wow.
And so yeah, that was very. Very satisfying, obviously.
That had to have been surreal.
Totally surreal. I mean, it still is, even just recounting it. It's like the most surreal thing ever. I mean, you know, it just doesn't get any better than that band. I mean, I've gone down many, many paths in my life as far as things I get into at different scenes and different bands and all that stuff. And then if I just put on Revolver or A Day in the Life or I mean, Magical Mystery Tour or... you know, Sgt. Pepper, like everything else just kind of melts away.
Wow.
Those really are like, that's just the finest records ever made, you know, by that band. So
absolutely. Wow.
Incredible.
That's deep, man. That's good.
That is. That's cool. So Jason, back to your solo material. We've talked about most of your stuff, but all of them are my favorites, I guess. But one of my personal favorites is Bliss Descending. And when you put that EP out, it's special to me because that was actually the first time that I met you. It was at an in-store appearance in San Diego. You were doing a live show and signing at M Theory. It was a record store down in San Diego.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that show.
Yeah, that was great. I had so much of your stuff to have signed that my wife took half of my stack. And when she got up to you, you asked her what her name was. She said Jeff. So that was kind of awkward because... And then I came up afterwards, and then my name was Jeff, but it was kind of weird. But anyways.
That's amazing.
Hopefully that can be included in some of the campaign coming up with the new stuff that you're planning on releasing. That EP is great.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, that was just kind of a collection. It wasn't necessarily meant to be an EP. That was just songs I was working on at the time. And I kind of rushed to put something together quite honestly, because I was going to be doing this little tour with Travis, opening up for them. And they, you know, they were just good friends of mine, but we, I wanted to have something new for fans and, you know, something that actually something new to potentially sell, on this tour. So I just scrambled to put that EP together. But yeah, the, you know, had I not made those, that EP, those would have, those songs, some of them or all of them would have probably been on my next record. But yeah, I think it's a strong EP. You know, that was also kind of the first stuff I ever did in Pro Tools. I very, very recently got the whole Pro Tools thing. And, you know, cause I felt pretty strongly about being a tape guy for, up until that point. I was kind of resisting the Pro Tools thing for a few years when everybody around me was getting it. And, I finally just bit the bullet because I also was wanting to get into soundtrack stuff, and you need to have like the recall availability of computer recording with score stuff, because you know there's so many people involved in that that you know somebody will be like, hey, just can you turn up this, and it's like I can't because it's on tape and I would have to remix the whole thing, and it's never going to sound the same. And so, yeah, I that was very, very early Pro Tools recording for me. So I hear that stuff, and I hear that it's early in that, you know, kind of in that world. But I also, I'm super, super proud of that.
Yeah, that EP is great. The cover, not so much, but the music on it is great.
That's fine. I'll take that.
Well, with this very attuned ear, I want to ask, I want to take it in a different direction and ask about one of the artists that you've, whose release you produced, and that was Daniel Johnston in 2009, and release Is and Always Was. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about what it was like working with Daniel in that capacity as a producer?
Yeah, I mean, that was crazy because I'm, that's kind of like a, I mean, I'm playing everything on that as well, except I think I had Joey play drums on about four things. I'm playing the rest of the drums, and then I had a friend, Woody, play something on one song, and everything else is me playing every single instrument. So in a way, that is kind of, it's like a lot of the things that I produce where I'm not a typical producer who's just kind of like a vibe guy sitting there like playing music, getting people excited, and then like assembling a band or finding all these other putting these components together. I am all the components usually when I produce something. So, and this record was no exception. Yeah, that came because a friend of mine who is his manager called me one day and was like, I have this crazy idea, and it is you doing your one-man band thing to Daniel Johnston's music. And I was like, you're totally insane. and that's not going to – I was like, that might not be something that Daniel Johnston fans really ever want to hear, because, you know, he's kind of – I was very familiar with his catalog and very respectful of his records, and I love "How Are You" and the brutal simplicity of that stuff. I love it, and I don't really do that. And so I was hyper aware of his fan base and of him, really. It's a respect for him and what he does. And I was like, yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know if that's, you know, I'm a bit more, for lack of a better term, polished than that. And
absolutely, yeah.
So, but he was like, no, I really, it'll be a different record for him, but I think it'd be amazing. And when I thought about it, and then he was like, well, why don't we just meet He and I and his brother will fly out, and you guys just meet, because, you know, Daniel might take a look at you and think that you're the devil, and then it's not going to work, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you just don't know how he's going to interpret people sometimes, because he's pretty sick.
Yeah.
And he's schizophrenic, and so, and he's not schizophrenic, but like when you say, "Man, that guy's schizophrenic," you know, he's like a dick.
Yeah.
Like, no, this is clinical schizophrenia.
Right.
So we met up, and I remember I walked into this. It was over at the 101 Cafe on Franklin here in Hollywood, and I walk in, and there he is, and he goes, so you're the producer. And I was like, that's like the first thing he said to me, and it was like kind of salty. And I was like, well, I'm a producer. I don't know if I'm the producer. And he's like, oh, okay. And then we just started talking, and you know, we actually really hit it off. And he really wants to talk a lot about the Beatles, and the fact that I had played with Paul certainly didn't hurt the situation. And so we went over to my studio that day, and I recorded probably 50 song ideas that he had, just bang, one after another. And they would all start really cool. And then some of them I could tell there was a song there that we could definitely work on. And then some of them would just kind of like descend into this very interesting chaos, but chaos.
Wow.
So I realized, okay, this is like, there's going to be a lot of sort of me kind of like honing these songs into something that he's not really playing them like right now, but hopefully he'll get his head around what I do. So I made sure we did that for 2 days, went very well. And then I kept trying to spark up this conversation with him, like, you know, so are you cool if I'm, you know, if I change these songs a bit, like, you know, he said, I said, I know you're, you know, we all know you're really into the Beatles, because you talk about them a lot. And, that's fantastic. But what about like going a little bit more into outer space, a little bit more like, you know, some synths and, you know, just kind of like, not necessarily just kind of this traditional rock and roll thing. And he's like, oh, yeah, I love it. So that's what I did. He left, and then I made the record on my own. And I made the record on my own. And then he came back about two or three months later. I worked on that record for a long time. And again, I was trying to make it not sound like a Jason Faulkner record. I really wanted it to sound like a Daniel Johnston record, but I wanted it to still. I mean, there's a certain point where it's like I do what I do, and I can't really do just anything. Like, it doesn't feel right. So it's played the way it's played because that's how I play. But I did always kind of have him and his fan base kind of in the back of my mind. So I tried to do things that I thought made sense to him. It's just, that's part of the whole thing of a good producer, is a very sympathetic person. And, you know, so I was almost scared of what the reaction would be to that record. And I remember when I remember his brother called me after Daniel finally got it. I was like, oh my God, like, is he going to be like, what is this? but he's like, it's like, you made me sound like the Beatles. And
whoa.
Yeah, he said that. He said, it sounds like the Beatles. And I'm like, oh, okay. And he's like, it's my favorite record. Like, he's like, I mean, every time I see him, he's like, I love your record. And he's talking about his, but
wow.
The one that I made.
Wow.
But he calls it my record.
Wow.
I really love your record. It's my favorite one. But yeah, I mean, that was, again, that was somebody that I immediately had a lot of sort of empathy for when I met him. And I just really kind of cared about him immediately and how what I do would make him feel and make sure that he likes it, you know, because he can get kind of triggered. Oh, we all can.
Yeah.
Something can set you off, and then you can never look at it with clean eyes or listen to it with clean ears again, you know. And I just was just wanted to make sure that he dug it, and he did. And
wow.
You know, it, my favorite thing was it had, you know, it got like a crazy review, and I think it was Mojo or one of those Q or Uncut or one of those British mags. And it was like, finally, Daniel Johnson is at the helm of this psychedelic rock band that's provided by Jason Faulkner and all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, he wasn't even there. But, wow. You know, that means, to me, that means job well done.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And does it get any better when the artist is telling you that it's his favorite record? I mean, that it can't get any better than that. So we have just,
that's right, exactly.
We have just a few more questions. And speaking of slightly eccentric people, though this is totally different, that I wanted to talk a little bit about Make It Be, the record that you did with R. Stevie Moore. So the second time that I met you, you and I spoke briefly after the Rain Parade concert that was at the Echoplex in Los Angeles. I talked to you for a little bit after the show. And that's one of the things that I remembered us talking about in our conversation, that you were so excited about this record that was coming out that you did with R. Stevie Moore. Of course, this was before it came out. But few months later, in 2017, the two of you released Make It Be on Bar None Records. And you guys, you even played a show or two, right, at South by Southwest or something promoting the record, right?
That's right, yeah. We played three shows. Well, one of them was really short because somebody had actually stole R. Stevie Moore's bass right before we went on. The band that played before us accidentally put it with their gear and left. So, and that was at a Brooklyn Vegan show. And those things apparently are run like clockwork. So the fact that we were scrambling, trying to find his bass and finally found it, but it had cut into our set time by about a half an hour. So we only played like two or three songs with that one, but we played a great full set, at a different venue. I can't remember the name, but yeah, I mean, that was just such a thrill. I mean, I'm a rabid fan of R. Stevie Moore, and we first met. The first time I became aware of him was when there was a record shop called Aaron's Records. You guys know Aaron's, of course.
Yes. Yes.
On Highland, when that record shop was going out of business, I was in there digging through all the records, and I was flipping through the 10 inches, and I saw this weird 10 inch with like a Xerox cover with like the Revolver Beatles cover, but it had like all these, this weird looking, his face plastered all over the Beatles. And it's called Revolve. And I was like, well, I'll be having this. who would do that? I've got to know about this. And the name was familiar even at that point, but I didn't have any of the records. And so I loved that record immediately. It's an EP. And then I feel like he reached out to me maybe because he had heard me talking about him in the press or something. And I think it was back MySpace days. He sent me a message and we kind of started communicating on MySpace. It's also around the same time that, because I used to be good friends with Errol Pink, and we were driving around one day and me some stuff. He gave me a bunch of one-off cassettes back in the day, and he was playing something in my car. And I was just like, dude, I don't even know what you're into. Like, you know, like it's so obscured. Like, I just don't even know what you're into. And he's like, you know what I'm really into? I'm really into this guy, R. Stevie Moore. And I was like, what? Because that's the only other time I had heard that name uttered from somebody else's mouth. Wow. And I was like, I love that guy. He goes, yeah, he's like my favorite. And so that we bonded over our suit. And so then, I can't remember when it was, but it would have been like 2000. I don't know when it was. It was late 2000s. Ariel and Stevie decided to work on some stuff together, and they called me to see if they could come over and do some of it at my house in my studio. And that's when Stevie and I first really met and just really hit it off. And while we were working on that stuff, Stevie and I were like, you got to come back and let's do our own record. And so that's when all that started. And his Stevie, his dear friend John Ferguson, who unfortunately is no longer with us. Sweet John basically paid for Stevie to come out, and he flew him out. I think Stevie was only here for 10 days, I think.
Oh, wow.
We made that record in 10 days.
Dang.
Playing everything ourselves. I knew that I had such limited time with him that, like, the record wasn't finished when he left, but I tried to make sure I had him covered, mm-hmm. you know, before he left, because I knew it wasn't going to be able to come out again. So yeah, that was just, I mean, Stevie is so prolific and wildly creative and musical. He's actually more, in a way, more musical than I thought he was going to be. And I only mean that as far as being an instrumentalist. You know, there's a lot of people that are extremely musical, but they can't really play what they want to hear.
Yeah,
but they can get close to it, you know. And I knew, of course, that he could play since I have his catalog. But some of that is so difficult to really hear what's going on that you know, I just wasn't sure. But the guy is just he's a master, and you know, dare I say, he feels the same about myself.
Warm regards.
Together making that. It was just quick, like, just whoever's got an idea, just do it. And we talk, and if one of us doesn't like it, it's like, hey, I don't like that, all right, next idea. And it was awesome. It was effortless.
Wow. That, so make,
yeah,
it, make it,
and be, I mean, you know,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just gonna say, I mean, like, I still play that record for people, you know, if people come over and we have drinks and stuff, and I put that record on. And it's just like a glorious record, in my opinion. Oh, and the other thing is, the CD, the original version of that record is almost an hour long. I think it's like 57 minutes long. It's a behemoth, right? And so I remember when we signed with Bar None, and they were like, "Yeah, well, double record for sure, double record, yeah, yeah, yeah." And then, of course, predictably, once things started going in production, they're like, is there any way to make this a single record? Because it costs less, of course.
Right.
And I was like, Stevie and I were both like, what are you guys talking about? You know, of course it's, you know what the record is. There's no surprise here. We've been doing this. We've been talking about this for like 6 months already. And they're like, yeah, well, we're going to have to do a single disc. So what's funny is that the knee-jerk reaction, again, that Stevie and I both had was like, fuck you, you know, like, no.
Yep.
And then I started thinking about it. We both started thinking about it. And I was like, let me just edit this thing down and take a couple of these long pieces out, take some of the spoken word out, but I'm going to move everything around. I'm going to make this thing that flows like it's a concept record, really. And so that's what I did. I didn't spend another month like kind of re-editing this record. And I have to say the LP, which is the much shorter version of this album, is such a concise, like, punch in the face. It's like one of my favorite things that I've ever done. Just listening to that record in one sitting, side A, side B, all the way through. It's just like, it's this thing, man. It's like streamlined, and it really works, in my opinion. It works better than the long originally intended LP. So I have to say that, you know, the thriftiness of Bar None and all of their indie brethren worked out with this one.
Wow. Jason, we have one last question. And, you know, we can absolutely sense the pride and joy and, you know, the fun in how you describe a lot of the projects that you worked on. So with all your work creating your own material, producing other artists, yeah, playing with bands, supporting other artists as a musician, we have to ask, what do you prefer? Which of those roles do you love to be in?
Well, they're all so different for me. But I would have to say, I mean, of course, my own records are my pride and joy kind of thing. And you know, there's no greater thrill for me than dreaming up an idea for a song, then recording it alone and getting it to sound like a band, getting it to not sound like one brain.
Right.
That's a huge endeavor in and of itself. That's something that I feel like I have I've been blessed with a talent for that, because I'm so aware of each instrument and I love them all equally. I'm not like a guitar player that begrudgingly plays some piano because I can't find a dude to play. You know, it's like, I love all the instruments the same. So putting these songs together is like, and doing it myself and then feeling it start to work and become something that I can then almost listen to objectively as a fan is like my favorite experience in this life. So it's absolutely making my own records. And I have no excuse, or I don't even have a really good reason why I don't make more records, other than what I think I touched on earlier, which was just kind of like a bit of depression that happened as a result of, you know, I'm just so tired of people going, why does everybody know this guy? It's like most interviews I do are like, you know, that's kind of like the focal point. It's like, it's such a sad story. It's like, I'm actually not sad. You know, like I'm doing this. This is coming from joy. Even my dark songs that are kind of questioning some heavy stuff, it's still coming from a place of joy. So I'm not bummed. I mean, certainly I get envious, or I can get kind of twisted about, you know, I see other people doing really well. But I'd have to say those emotions are kind of the younger me. Like now I'm just kind of like, you know, I have a cool studio. I can make things that I really like the way they sound. And it's all curated weird gear that it's all me. You know, it's like my personality. So I'm totally blessed to have that. And to still have like the desire, you know, it's all about the desire. And the desire never left me. It was just all the machinery that's involved in like just even putting something out. And, you know, but I'm overlooking all of that negative stuff at the moment and just focusing on making the best record I've ever made. So that's where I'm at.
And we're looking forward to that.
Yeah. I am so excited to have new material from you, Jason. Cause yeah, like I mentioned at the top of the episode, that's what I appreciate about you is your songs, your singing, your songwriting. Mm-hmm. You're just a craftsman when it comes to writing songs. I mean, it's in all your projects. So we're super excited.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Well, we wanted to thank you for taking so long to talk to us. We appreciate you taking time. I'm a huge fan, and we're really looking forward to the new material, and I'm really looking forward to seeing you on stage again supporting this new material. So once again, thank you so much, Jason, for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you guys.
Yeah. Thank you so much,
Jason. And enjoy the new Hammond organ.
Yes.
I will. All right.
It's a secret. That's right. Okay.
Yeah.
Secret sauce.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's okay. You can say Hammond, but nobody knows where it is. There's so many different kinds, so it's fine.
All right.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Jason. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Hey, Soraya.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
That's a cool dude.
Isn't he the best?
Look, for those of you who don't know, Jeff's at his home. I'm in mine. We're in two different parts of Southern California. The man, Jason, and Jason Faulkner was wherever he was.
Yeah.
But he makes it feel like the world is just really small, and that his music, like, he just brings you in. Like it or not, he brings you in.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good way of saying it.
Because the world felt very small and very intimate as he was talking about his work. And you can really sense that pride. Like, I didn't just pull that out of the air. You could, every time we asked him a question, you know, he could just, I realized he could talk 3 hours about that one question. You sensed it.
Yeah, and we didn't even remotely touch all the things that he's been a part of. Like, if you go on Discogs or
cherry pick, cherry pick questions for this, but
exactly,
he's a guy that can talk about so much because he's done so much. What a great guy, great guy, and a really, just a really profound artist.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you could,
everything you had to say.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. Very passionate about the music and what he's putting out. And I had no idea that he's working on a new project. So I'm so
scoop,
excited.
Scoop, scoop, everybody. Jason Faulkner, new material. Hopefully by the end of the year.
Yes. And re-releases of his,
which is even material. Better. And hopefully he'll find the right home for those, the first two releases, Can You Still Feel, and what was the other one? Oh,
Presents Author Unknown.
Author Unknown.
Yeah, and I think he even mentioned that the Japanese release that he did, that they were going to work on that one as well and maybe release it at the same time.
All Quiet on the Noise Floor, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. I just love the fact that he's got a vision for, okay, I want to re-release these, but I don't want to re-release them as, like, you know, here's what was long gone, but rather have it be kind of a new approach from a new perspective. I that's really, that's an interesting, what do you say? I don't want to be that legacy artist because I'm still creating.
Yeah.
I thought that was really poignant.
It sounds like he's the kind of guy that went through all of these experiences with different bands and different situations, and he really took things out of those experiences that he learned and now applies them in his life moving forward. And I mean, what's greater than that in our lives, in learning from previous experiences and making our future better because of those experiences?
I mean, and also look at some of the artists that he's worked with, you know, just that story alone of working with R. Stephen Moore.
Yeah.
And Daniel Johnston, and, you know, each brings something very unique to the table. And he found a voice in there that hadn't been heard yet, you know, and it came out.
Yeah.
His approach is just, it's really neat.
I thought that was really interesting with the Daniel Johnston project, how he was very respectful of the artist and of the fans of that artist, in that while he was helping to create that record, he had the artist and the artist's fans in mind while still putting his passion, his heart and soul into those records, still being respectful of the music.
And I think, you know, that kind of brings us full circle to, you know, what he said about on Vermillion, the producer not being respectful of that vision, you know, that's a lesson learned. You store that. And then when you have the opportunity, you know, to do something similar of work with an artist, but still respect their vision, like you put that lesson into action. And I thought that was just really interesting how he said that. And then other thing I learned, don't give Jason Faulkner no rules. Give him a deadline, because he will create some magic. Dang. 10 days. Wow. 10 days for that our Stevie Moore album.
Yeah.
10 days.
Yeah. That album was actually my favorite album of 2017 of any artist.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. So deadlines and don't tell me nothing.
Yes.
There you go. Yes. Wow, this was a lot of fun.
It really was.
I'm glad we found it time to talk.
Absolutely.
All right, man. So, gente, agrubiar.
Groove on, Paisley people.
Later.
Hi, my name is Jason Faulkner, and I have an album out called Can You Still Feel? This is the first single, Eloquence. Have you seen the papers? There's a wonder kid, and he's only two. He's only two. He's playing Beethoven on his violin. There's something I don't need tickets to, 'cause I've seen Eloquence and its purest sense grab. Shake it so free. And I'm stunned. I mean, who invited this fickle frown? Why won't it stay? Why does it go anyway? Hey, now find out the hard way that it's going. Back to stay. Back to stay. Yeah, hey. Yeah, I'm lost and I'm lonely, 'cause my baby, come back to play. Come back to me, little lady, please. Come back to little old me. I'm a tourist, even in my own skin. 'Cause I've seen eloquence in its purest sense grab hold of me and then shake it so free. And I'm stunned. I mean, who invited this fickle frown? Why won't it stay? Where does it go anyway? Yeah, I've seen eloquence in its purest sense grab hold of me. Shake.